with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! About a minute past the hour as we get the program started for this evening. Spring's here, but spring-like weather is not. It's kind of nasty and cold outside. And for those of you wondering, hey, why didn't Bob turn on the camera? Well, the fact of the matter is, I didn't feel like it. Because, frankly, I didn't want people playing Count the Drips. Roof's had kind of a hard time of it lately. And there's a bucket. And hopefully I've tweaked the compressor and so forth enough that you won't hear the thunk, thunk, thunk inside the bucket. Ah, frustrating. But, you know, just another day in paradise being a member of the liberal media elite, right? Right, sure. It is Front Porch Friday on the Horn, and we can get lighthearted if we want to. A little update for you. The run downhill for March's fundraising is proceeding apace. We are now at that point where we need only 61 more Horn listeners. Well, wait. 60 more Horn listeners at $10 apiece, and we'll be done with fundraising for the month of March. 60 folks. Could we maybe pull it off during the program? I don't know. Can we get done with it in time to finish March on schedule for... Yeah, I think we should be able to. One would hope. So that's where we stand. The button is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. And 60 folks, or some combination thereof, giving $10 apiece, or some combination thereof, will find us finished with fundraising for the month of March, and at least not sweating the month of April, because each previous month pays, well, you know what I mean. The bills keep coming, in other words. The bills keep coming. So that's where we are, and any help that you can offer will be greatly appreciated. And all of incredible gratitude. Incredible gratitude goes out to those who are, in fact, willing to help. Jesus, Jim. Webcam not on. You in drag? No. I left my Scarlett O'Hara. Well, it's at the cleaners. My Scarlett O'Hara, the hoop skirt for the barbecue at Ashley's. No, it's just a matter of, trust me, the drip into the bucket beside me here is annoying enough and embarrassing enough without me broadcasting it. So, no, that's why the camera's not on. But you know what? If spring ever does get here, I have big plans. I have big plans, some of which include roof work, and others of which include maybe even a general sort of shuffling of all the stuff here inside the studio so that we can make it more camera friendly, because we're never going to make my face more camera friendly. Short of something like, you know, massive face replacement plastic surgery or something. Mm-mm, no. So we'll just do the best we can with what's surrounding the face. And that, but really, warm weather, you just can't take a bunch of electrically driven equipment out and set it in the rain and hope for the best. Not yet. No. Let's see. Where to begin? Well, first of all, we have a very important conversation coming tonight. If you've checked out the show post at headonradionetwork.com or seen my tweets or my Facebook postings about the same, you know that this is a conversation that means a great deal to me, and it is information that I think, well, part of the reason I so urgently wanted to get this information out there is that I fear that apart from Jeff Biggers and me, and maybe a few others, the information isn't going to get out there. There is a desperate situation developing in one of the world's most desperate countries, Bangladesh. A desperate country, despite the fact that the global capital predators are looking with that sort of perverted, leery, dirty old man in an overcoat kind of glance their way. And part of that dirty old man in an overcoat glance is this topic of the conversation we will have in short order. We're going to be joined here in about, 24 minutes or so by Paula Palmer. Paula Palmer is director of the Global Response Program of Cultural Survival, Inc. of Boulder, Colorado. Boulder seems to be just a nice place. And Paula is actively involved in trying to get the word out about some nasty, nasty, nasty business that is taking place in Bangladesh. Jeff Biggers posted about it yesterday, on Huffington Post and over at Alternet as well. Jeff's post was called Big Coal WikiLeaks Emergency in Bangladesh. Does Obama support the removal of 100,000 villagers? Jeff is not one to mince words. I consider him a dear friend, and it's not a matter of my consideration. He simply is a magnificent writer and a tremendous journalist. One of the things that comes out of WikiLeaks is the fact that a member of the Obama administration, dear God, of all people, a member of the Obama administration, the U.S. ambassador to Dhaka, James Moriarty, held talks last year with the chief energy advisor to Bangladesh and put pressure on him to approve plans by a filthy, filthy British company called Global Coal Management, which used to be Asia Energy, to reopen a vile strip mine. They call it open cast coal mining over there. A vile strip mine in Bangladesh. It had been closed after massive civil unrest back in 2005. And for some reason or another, the Obama administration wants it reopened. Now, I don't want to give away too much of the story, but, well, you will hear everything you need to know from Paula Palmer. Now, it was closed in 2006. I'm sorry, not 2005. Government thugs, acting on behalf of the coal company, slaughtered three human beings at a grassroots demonstration against that mine. That is its legacy, and that is the history. So Paula Palmer of Cultural Survival, Inc., who has been actively involved in the response to this. She's the director of the Global Response Program at Cultural Survival, Inc., will join us at about 6:30 if everything works out the way we have it planned. Okay? And again, this is one of those moments where I get to feel really, really good about why the horn exists. And I get to be incredibly inspired by your dedication to making sure that the horn continues to exist. You know, I told you the other day that I have this weird little habit of looking up in the sky and seeing jets passing overhead, you know, passenger planes, and thinking about all the lives that we don't know if we will ever touch or not. Well, it is in the dissemination of vital information, like the unfolding crisis in Bangladesh, and lives that we will never see nor know, and which we are scarcely able to imagine, but that we may touch simply by trying to advocate and give voice over here to the voiceless. You know that, you know about the geography of Bangladesh, right? At or near sea level, most of the country. One of the countries on Earth most ravaged by the advancing threat of global climate change. And yet, it apparently suffers from the curse of having coal under it. And if you have coal under you, no matter how well you think you may try to live your life, you are accursed. Because somebody, somewhere, in a bespoke suit with shiny black leather shoes, doesn't give a damn about your existence and will gladly trade your existence for his profits. And shareholders cluck and prattle and coo over portfolios and rises in share prices. And they babble about energy needs while people are displaced and starve. And so by providing information like this, we hope in our own small way, you and I, we, the Horn family, to make some kind of a difference in the world. You know, I've said for a long time that there needs to be a sort of global linkage between all the peoples of the earth that are tormented by coal, that are tormented by the search for oil, that we need some way of reaching out the hand of a brother or a sister and touching the hand of another brother or another sister and grasping that hand firmly and forming an unbreakable bond, not even subject to ruination by those who serve the blood-soaked golden altar of unholy profit. And it's moments like this that I realize that that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. Or at least attempting to do. And by the way, you know, if you want to keep up with what's happening in the program, I encourage you to go to headonradionetwork.com. There's a daily show post there so that you can see the direction that the show may be going in. And you can even access it via your smartphone now. The among other things, the Progressive Voices app is out for your iPhone. I don't think it's out yet for BlackBerry or Android. But you can get information, and you can follow the website from practically anywhere you are. If you get that Progressive Voices app, it's available in the App Store on your iPhone. And it is an aggregator of all things progressive, all media liberal. And lo and behold, Agnes was taking a look at it the other night, and there it is. The Horn is listed among the links in the Progressive Voices app. We haven't quite made it up to being a direct link to the audio stream yet, but you know what? You can do that too. The more of you that get the Progressive Voices app and send messages saying, hey, we need Bob on the talkers page, well, the more likely that is to happen. So help yourself. Help yourself, especially if you like to be able to follow, Malloy's on the front page there. You can listen to, isn't it cool? You can listen to Malloy on your iPhone. And, of course, you can listen to the Horn via TuneIn Radio. TuneIn Radio. And I believe our archives, yes, the previous day's program or the rerun stream is also available at Stitcher Radio. So the reach of liberal media into the non-terrestrial broadcast sphere is growing. So that's one of the. But seriously, the Bangladesh Pulbari story is front and center of the program this evening. But there's a lot of other things as well. I've emailed back and forth with Sandra today as she sent me stories and commented about what continues to transpire in Japan, bad and getting worse. I will defer to our good friend Robert in Kitakyushu as to attitudes and behavior of Japanese political types, but somehow it struck me that Japanese politicians don't refer to things as very grave and serious unless they're probably past very grave and serious. The Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan referred to the nuclear the attempt to stabilize the nuclear disaster there in Fukushima as very grave and serious. Water with 10,000 times the amount of radiation in it than what is considered safe. No, don't drink the water. Bad. And of course, there's a linkage, whether it's the BP disaster last year, the more recent Gulf spill that you heard Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen talk about on the Green News Report last night, that a Houston-based oil company tried to cover up and say was only 5 gallons. Until it was found that, no, they had a terrible, terrible leak at a supposedly capped wellhead, and they were caught red-handed trying to fix it without reporting it. Whether it's that or a nuclear disaster in Japan or a coal-driven disaster, you know, we've got one of those shining beacons, existentially speaking, I suppose. There is a blinking beacon in the night saying, you know, warning, Will Robinson, warning! And yet all those bespoke suit-wearing, shiny black shoes-treading worshippers at the unholy altar of unholy prophet keep looking. What's that blinking? Something's blinking. Do you see anything blinking? I don't see anything blinking. Let's make some more gold! While we die. Last night I played that great Peter Tosh song, Downpressor Man. Where will they run? Where will they run? These profiteers, these blood-soaked priests upon the unholy golden altar of profit. Where will they run? Who will take care of Flush Flimball's jiggling corpulent ass? When the world is toxic, who will look out for the well-being of Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Jeffrey Immelt at GE? Who will do that? when they're done killing off the rest of us? I think it's a fair question. We've got just a few minutes before I get Paula Palmer on the line, so I've got a blinking light here. Let's go to it. Hey, welcome to the program.
Brother Bob.
Cossack, what's up, man?
Oh, it's a short wait. Not much. I'm just sitting here and doing some research. Horrible thing. And I don't know. The more I dig into this, the more furious I get with a lot of people. What I'm talking about is the situation in Libya. And
oh, by the way, I didn't say that. Yes, let me get that out of the way real quick. It's day 7 of your war on the brown people in Libya. Okay, go ahead.
Well, no, it's not our war anymore. It's NATO's war now.
Oh, only the no-fly zone part.
Right.
We still have ownership of all the ground attacks.
Oh, well, that's to be expected. After all, nobody knows better how to slaughter unarmed civilians than we do. We're so practiced at it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is what kind of drove me crazy about that one caller who said, well, we got to do something. We've got to. Bob, have you ever seen a humanitarian bomb in your life?
Nope, never once.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the...
Well, no, I have yet to discover the existence of edible cordite.
Right. I mean, unless I'm grossly misinformed, I have yet to see a bomb that, after being deployed, lands and scurries around and comforts the injured and ministers to the wounded. And I haven't seen it.
No.
I have seen what these bombs do, though. I mean, this is what I keep in mind. To most Americans, whenever we hear about some foreign involvement, it's those people over there who are getting it, and we don't care. Well, when they were bombing Serbia, okay, one of the deaths that keeps on popping up in my mind, you have children.
Absolutely.
As I know. And it was a little 3-year-old girl sitting on her potty before going to bed when a cruise missile blew up next door and took her head off.
Tough even to contemplate, isn't it?
I mean, when you look at your daughters, can that image even form itself in your head?
No, it can't.
And you don't want it to. You desperately want it to think of some. And I've seen a picture of the little girl. And I know where she lived. It's a civilian area, Bob.
Sure. I mean, the Muammar Gaddafi is an asshole. So naturally, he's going to position things in civilian areas.
Well, we do too.
And we're going to take the bait.
Right. Well, not only that, I mean, if you remember during the first Iraq war, when we bombed a bomb shelter, of all things, and one of the excuses was, well, it was surrounded with barbed wire, so we thought it was a military installation.
Well, and, you know, Matt Osborne over at Osborne, Inc. today posited that air power is not much good against mobile targets, you know, tanks and the like.
Right. Well, it can be, but it isn't quite frequently. If you remember, again, going back to the bombing of Yugoslavia, remember how that idiot general was braying about how, well, we've destroyed all of Serbian armor. It's all, we have wiped it out. And when the Serbs left Kosovo, they left with all but 13 of their tanks.
Right.
What we were blowing up were very cheap microwave ovens that they had set up to act as beacons, and that's what we were blowing up. No, it's just a half million dollar missile that we used to blow up $39 microwave. Yeah, that sounds good. And the thing is, yes, I wouldn't dream of being under Gaddafi's thumb. However, what do we know, we as American citizens? What does the average American know about Libya?
Bupkis, sure. Hey, Cossack, yeah. I hate to cut it short, but I've got to get Paula on the line, and
right.
We'll pick things up, maybe other topics after this discussion, okay?
Absolutely.
All right, take care, Cos.
Bye
now.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I don't mean to be abrupt, but when you got a conversation scheduled, you kind of got to stick to the schedule where humanly possible. As noted, a conversation coming up. Oh, by the way, an email coming in from Sandra about NATO. Don't get confused. NATO is the USA. And that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. So we'll take a little break and come back. And a conversation with Paula Palmer about the humanitarian crisis about to unfold in Bangladesh. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice. You're listening to The Horn.
Oh,
minutes before the hour. This is The Horn. I'm Bob. And as I mentioned throughout the first half hour of the program, we are joined on the phone right now by Paula Palmer. She is the director of the Global Response Program of Cultural Survival, Inc. out of Boulder, Colorado, and is an authority on the Fulbari mine, open cast pit mine in Bangladesh, and as well as the company behind it and the drive to reopen it. Paula, welcome to the program, and thank you for taking time to talk to us.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be with you.
Let me start out by noting that it was Jeff Bigger's interview with you that that drove or moved me to make contact, so credit where credit is due. As I told you in our introductory email, I live in what is referred to as coal country here in Appalachia, so I have a feeling of kinship with anyone who is tormented by the coal, by the coal industry. Could you begin by just telling us a little bit about the area of Bangladesh where this open cast pit mine is and the people who live there?
Well, first, let me correct your tense, your verb tense, because so far we don't have a mine. And that's a very important point. We are trying to prevent the construction of a coal mine in the Fulbari region of northwestern Bangladesh. This is a highland region that is known as an agricultural region. It's one of the few regions in Bangladesh where crops aren't frequently wiped out by flooding. And so it's an important resource for the people of Bangladesh. Rice is grown there, and it produces surpluses of rice every year. This is in a country, of course, where almost half of the people are underfed, undernourished, and so the production of rice and other food crops is very important to Bangladesh. This is a region, as I said, that produces food for more than its own population. Its own population is largely indigenous. These are people who trace their ancestry back 5,000 years. These are ancient cultures, as well as people who have moved into the area and who are doing subsistence agriculture as well as production for the rest of the country. And this is where a British company has now done explorations, have found coal that is down about 1,000 feet deep, and they want to dig that coal out over a period of about 40 years, and it will mean the excavation of an area of about 15,000 acres. They would start by digging one enormous pit, and then they would move it. they would fill that back in and dig another one and eventually cover that whole 15,000-acre region. And in order to do that, they would displace, well, there are various estimates for the number of people who would be displaced. The company itself says that they would displace 40,000 people. Other studies that have been done show, including studies that were commissioned by the Bangladesh government, show that that number could be as high as 220,000 people over the life of the mine. It would displace the people who are right in the footprint of the mine, right where the pits would be dug. But it would also probably eventually displace quite a few additional people in the surrounding area, whose water would be sucked dry,
or poisoned.
Because they would have to, in order to mine these deep pits, they would have to do what they call dewatering. They would have to pump the water out of those 1,000-foot deep pits to keep it dry, and that would lower the water table for a large region of beyond the footprint of the mine itself.
Well, I suppose my confusion came in the fact that there have been there has been determined resistance in the past to similar sorts of mining? Is that what took me sideways?
No, they've been protesting this mine. They've been protesting the people in Bangladesh from this region and everyone who is concerned about the environmental impacts as well as the human rights impacts. People have been protesting against the prospect of this mine, the possibility of
the very idea of it.
And the licensing of it since 2005. We're talking about protests that involve tens of thousands of people. And as I said, they started really protesting in 2005. There was a huge demonstration in 2006 where the government actually responded with quite a bit of violence against the protesters, and several people were killed. Three people were killed by police or army representatives of the government during those protests. But the protests have continued, and in fact, there are protests on the streets of Bangladesh right now. This week, protests are building up to a big day of protest next Monday, in which they really hope that the outcome will be that the Prime Minister will finally say, no, we will not build this mine.
I read the articles that were linked in your interview with Jeff Biggers, and the thing that just sort of created this sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach is that advocacy for the go ahead for this mine is coming from members of the Obama administration. Do I at least have that part correct?
Yes. Yes, unfortunately, the U.S. ambassador, this is discovered through WikiLeaks, by the way, the U.S. ambassador has expressed his desire to the Prime Minister and other members of the Bangladesh government for the project to go through, and that's because, according to his own statement, 60% of the investment in this project is from U.S. investors. That's principally the Luxor Capital Group, which is owned by Christian Leon in the U.S. And so apparently the U.S. ambassador is more concerned about Mr. Leon and his fellow investors making potential profits on this mine than he is about the welfare of the 200,000 some Bangladeshis whose livelihoods and lands and ancient cultures would be forever disrupted by the construction of this mine.
Well, this quote from U.S. Ambassador Moriarty of July in last year, as disclosed by WikiLeaks, in which he says, open pit mining seemed the best way forward. I couldn't help reading that, Paula, without wondering, best way for who?
Well, that's exactly the question, isn't it? And you, as you said, you have experience in Appalachia. That's an important question to ask, and in Bangladesh, it's certainly an important question to ask. The company that wants to do this mine is a British company. There has been pressure also from the British government in favor of this mine, and you're aware of all of the environmental impacts of this kind of mining, as well as the tremendous injustice that this would be for all of the indigenous and other Bangladeshi families that would be directly affected. But also, there are so many ironies in this. In Bangladesh, according to Oxfam, is the country that is the most vulnerable to climate change impacts. 80% of the country is coastline or very low-lying lands. And with rising sea levels, Bangladesh is going to be one of the first countries to, apart from some small island nations, to be engulfed by ocean waters It's also very vulnerable to cyclones. And so protection of the coastlines of Bangladesh and prevention of climate change is something that you would think Bangladesh would be very concerned about, and it would just be a tremendous irony if one of what would become one of the world's largest open pit coal mines would occur in the country that is going to be most immediately and quickly impacted by the consequences of coal-fired power plants.
And that was one of my next questions. You don't dig coal unless usually you've got some idea of what you want to do with it in the first place. Is this coal that they plan to use for electricity generation or for steel making, or what purpose, or have they expressed it?
You know, they will. Part of the project is a coal-fired power plant, and their intention is to sell electricity to India, as well as to provide electricity for some parts of Bangladesh. But a lot of the coal would also be exported, and I'm not sure what the use would be for the coal that would be exported. But this is actually an additional concern. The environmental impact study that was done on this project said that there is a very high danger of impacts on the mangrove ecosystem, the mangrove forest that lines the coast of Bangladesh and that is its only protection against cyclones and high seas, that the coal barges that would take coal from this mine and export the coal, those coal barges would go right through this area of mangrove forest. It's quite a long distance that the coal barges would be moving through mangrove forest that has been protected by UNESCO. It's a
World Heritage site, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's recognized as an important environment for endangered species. It's one of the few places where the Bengal tiger and many other endangered species still thrive. Many, many Bangladeshi citizens depend on the marine resources, fish and other marine life that lives in the mangrove forest. And as I said, the forest itself is the greatest protection, the only protection that Bangladesh has against rising seas and cyclones. So there again, the threat of oil spills and coal spills and just moving barges up and down through this very delicate, very fragile, very important ecosystem is another reason to oppose this project. And in fact, there are now a number of international organizations, in addition to Cultural Survival, who have joined this campaign to stop the coal mine from ever being built. One of those is the Mangrove Action Project, because of the threat to the Sundarbans mangrove forest. Another organization that has also joined the campaign is Coal Swarm, and I'm sure you're aware of them.
Yes.
Because of their work in Appalachia. And another one is the International Accountability Project, which calls on international corporations to be accountable for their environmental impact and their human rights. Their human rights record. So we now have quite a few international organizations who have joined the campaign with a different focus. In the case of Cultural Survival, our primary focus is the protecting the rights and the environment and livelihoods of the indigenous peoples who would be affected by this.
Well, Paula, can you talk a little bit about those indigenous peoples, who they are, languages, the specialness of the cultures, that matters.
Yeah, it certainly does. When you have cultures that have existed for 5,000 years and you realize that a single project like this could bring them to a crashing close, the import of that really is striking. The cultures are many. There are as many as 23 different language groups, cultural groups in this region that would be affected by the mine if it is allowed to be built. Some of those people, at least 2,300, according to the company itself, at least 2,300 would be forcibly removed from the area because their homes are where the mine would be built. But the Union of Indigenous Peoples in Bangladesh, which is the organization that asked us to become involved, Cultural Survival, to become involved in the campaign, the Union of Indigenous Peoples says that they have done studies that show that as many as 50,000 Indigenous people, individual people, could be affected in the sense that they would either eventually have to leave, or that their livelihoods, or that their community life, or that their sacred sites, or their burial grounds would be altered or destroyed during one phase or another of this the construction of and operation of this coal mine. As I mentioned, these groups are small. We're not talking about 200,000 members of a specific cultural group. They tend to live in small villages and clans, and they make their living by as small farmers, and some of them also are famous for their weaving and the baskets. If they were to be removed from their home site, which is where they trace their ancestry and where the people of their communities have been buried and where they have performed ceremonies and weddings for, you know, so many centuries, if they were to be split up and dispersed, it might well be impossible for them to maintain those cultural traditions, having been broken up and the land of their ancestors.
And people with shattered cultures, very quickly, I'm sure within your research and the scope of your expertise, you know that people from shattered cultures cease not only to be a culture, but cease to be very, very quickly. I'm looking at a politico-linguistic map of Bangladesh right now, and I'm seeing names like Santali, Mundari, Kuruks, Rajbanshi, Assamese, and they're all in the northwest of the country, and they're all sort of mingled within each other. Mm-hmm. So you're not necessarily talking about groups that are, I guess you're talking about pockets or village or tribal life. Is that what is that how these are laid out?
Yes, you're not talking about something comparable to the Navajo Nation, where there's a large geographical area that belongs to the Navajo people. We are talking about smaller groupings of and as I said, 23 different cultural groups that are affected by this mine. That we have a map. Actually, I'd like to point out that we have a lot of other information, including maps of these settlements that of these indigenous settlements that would be affected by the mine on our website. Let me just go ahead and give that.
Do please.
It's just culturalsurvival.org, and yeah, there is a map there that shows the location of the indigenous settlements, and you can see the footprint of the mine imposed on them, and it's really quite telling.
Well, and one of the things that comes to mind is that with these groups dispersed as the in the way that you described them, that makes it somewhat easier for an operation like GCM, Global Coal Management, to divide and conquer, does it not?
But they're not having any success in that.
Okay, so no, so
in that intention.
They're maintaining solidarity then.
There is tremendous solidarity among the indigenous, the people who identify with a particular indigenous heritage, but also with the rest of the Bangladesh population in this area. As I said, these protests have been enormous. They during 2009 and again in 2010, both years they had what they called long marches, where thousands of people walked for days through many of the villages and towns where that would be affected by this mine. These companies always have the intention to divide and conquer, but we have just seen tremendous unity among the people who are opposed to this project.
And as you noted, you can't have coal mining without coal infrastructure. This extends far afield from the Fulbari, or is it Fulbari or Pulbari?
Fulbari.
Okay. From the Fulbari region. Has that motivated other, because this is a densely populated country, that motivated people outside the region to oppose the mine as well?
Yes, there is a large coalition of environmental organizations and human rights organizations based in the capital and at universities and other centers around the country that have all been involved in this. They are organizations that are advocating for human rights and for environmental protection and for an energy policy moving forward that doesn't rely on fossil fuels and that doesn't rely on this old model of foreign investment. That they're looking forward toward a new energy model that is empowering and that comes from the bottom up and that is Bangladeshi and that benefits the Bangladesh people and not foreign corporations.
This is a warm weather climate. It has a monsoon season, and it has a hot dry season, if I recall correctly. That would seem to make it amenable both to wind and solar. Am I sideways on this?
Well, I can't say that I myself have looked into very carefully into the prospects for other kinds of renewable energy development there. That's not my area of expertise.
Sure,
but this,
it's barely mine.
There are Bangladeshi the many of the organizations within Bangladesh that are opposing this mine are proposing other alternatives, and we're asking people. Let me take a step back. It's the Bangladeshi people who are really asking world citizens to support them in this, recognizing that the impacts of climate change are not only local, they are global, and that this needs to be a global movement to prevent this kind of project from moving forward and to bring to to all of our minds and all of our lives a different kind of focus about how we are going to take care of our needs as societies and provide energy in a way that does not do the kind of damage that this project would do. So they have sent out a call for international support, and cultural survival is really sort of a conduit for that call. And we're asking people to go to our website and see the addresses there of the Prime Minister of Bangladesh and other officials of the Bangladeshi government, and also it's important to send messages to James Moriarty, the U.S. ambassador. But the people in Bangladesh are really asking now for world citizens to stand with them and to make as strong a pitch as we can to the Prime Minister. She will be making a decision. She's announced that she will make a decision by June of this year. And so it's an immediate opportunity and an immediate need to make our voices heard. This is, I think, especially important right now because of the protests coming up on Monday, the 28th, just in a couple days. As I mentioned in previous protests, the government has used fairly repressive measures, and so we want to be very much we want to let the Bangladeshi government know that the world is watching, and that we care, and that we stand with the people of Fulbari and the other Bangladeshi citizens who are so concerned about this.
And I laud both cultural survival and your own work, Paula. I've got to tell you, I was stunned in doing some research, even though it would appear that some of it was inaccurate.
It was just a verb tense.
It was only a verb. It was right. But in doing my research, I went over and looked at the website of Global Coal Management, which is what used to be Asia Energy.
Yes.
And you know, I never cease to be amazed by the willingness of these predatory corporations to absolutely torment the language. You've probably seen it. They've got a tab on their website called Sustainable Development.
Yeah, isn't that nervy?
You know, it's made out, this. I think this page is actually comprised of electrons from solid brass, because they're going to develop projects that meet the highest international social and environmental performance standards. How in God's name do you do that when you're displacing 220,000 indigenes?
Well, they also have some kind of a slogan about power to the people, which is also just really offensive to all of us for whom power to the people means something else. Another thing that I've been shocked at is they have said to us, this is Global Coal Management, the company that wants to build this mine, that we shouldn't be so concerned about the environmental impacts here because they're only talking about a temporary change in land use. They're talking about digging.
No. Strip mining. Yeah, strip mining is forever.
15,000 acres, and they're saying, well, don't worry about it. It's just a temporary change in land use.
Yeah.
As if they could return it, you know, in any way to what it is now.
Yeah, I'm thinking no. Because, you know, here in Appalachia, we've got a pretty good idea of what their idea of temporary change is. We're talking, I had some real live, honest-to-goodness scientists on a year or so ago, and they were talking about the impacts of things like mountaintop removal, that the long-term effects of it are the kinds of things that you begin to have to measure in geologic epochs. And so the waters, and this is a very well-watered region. It's overly watered in some ways in Bangladesh. And as such, you're talking about the poisoning of water. You're talking about, with the coal-fired power plant, the poisoning of air, the poisoning of people. And I guess ultimately, despite all of GCM's high-blown hoorah, the fact of the matter is the Bangladeshi government does not have the infrastructure to make sure that they are compliant, do they? The United States government, for all it is, barely has the capability of making sure that an extractive industry is compliant. It's a bit much to think that the Bangladeshi government would be, isn't it?
Yes, and, you know, it's also true that this company, GCM, has not ever done this before. And so all of their predictions about how easy this is going to be and how it's not going to be harmful to people, that's all theoretical on their part. They've never done anything like this before themselves. And so, there's great reason to be concerned about the lack of experience and the of both and the technical ability on the part of both the Bangladesh government and the company itself. You know, I wanted to make one other observation here, and that is that there are internationally recognized rights that are just being run over in the plans and projections for this Fulbari coal mine. One is the right to water. The United Nations has recognized now people's right to water. And as I think I mentioned earlier, one of the government studies that was done on this estimated that 220,000 people would have reduced access to water. The UN has recognized that people have a right to water and that you can't just have a project like this take away a resource for life, which is what water is. That's one. Another is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and that declaration recognizes that Indigenous peoples have the right to free, prior, and informed consent whenever their lands or natural resources, their health, or the continuity of their cultural expression might be impacted by a project of some kind, an industrial project of any kind. They have the right to free, prior, and informed consent. And they are obviously, from all of the protests that we've seen for now 7 years, they clearly have not given their consent to this project. And so I guess what I want to say is just that we're not asking this company to, you know, offer extraordinary compassion to people. We are demanding, on the basis of the internationally recognized rights of Indigenous people and all people, to be protected from projects that can be so damaging to their lives, their well-being, their cultures, their livelihoods, their sense of place, and their
ability to exist on the planet.
Exactly.
I mean, this really does. I keep finding myself using the word existential more and more in my discussions. And this is the ultimate in existential questions, because we have yet to figure out how to keep a human being alive without water. And this is a nightmare scenario, what you're doing is critical. And will there be any? Let me ask you this, Paula. Will there be any kind of follow-ups after the March 28th protest or rally or the event that is planned? How can people find out? How can they continue to follow it and hopefully make their own voices heard? You mentioned earlier writing to Moriarty, writing to the administration, writing to Congress people. Is there an ongoing journalistic or documentary effort to help folks have a voice?
Well, we on our Cultural Survival website will keep posting updates to this campaign. Again, we encourage all the listeners to not only follow this, but also lend your voice and help us persuade the Prime Minister to make a decision for her people and for the land of Bangladesh and against this mine. So on our website, culturalsurvival.org, you can follow this case. And also there's a very good website at the International Accountability Project that and also Mangrove Action Project. Coal Swarm also has information on this on their website. So those are ways that people can follow what's happening, and we hope that Jeff Biggers will continue to follow this also and continue his posts.
Well, Jeff has considerable powers of bird dogging. He won't let go of this thing, because if there's anybody who has a real grasp on what it means for peoples to be subjected to the horrors of the extractive industries, probably more so than anybody else in this country, I would say it is Jeff Biggers.
Well, you know, I really sort of love the idea of sort of people-to-people solidarity. We know from many of the campaigns that we have done, and we have been doing this kind of campaign work for 20 years now, helping indigenous peoples stop projects that they feel are not in the interest of their communities, for health reasons, for cultural reasons, for environmental reasons. When they feel that no one is paying attention to them, they ask us to sort of internationalize their struggle to prevent environmental destruction on their lands. And we do that through our website and through international letter writing campaigns. These campaigns have been successful in many cases, even when we have not achieved the exact goal that we set out to achieve. We so frequently hear from the indigenous people who are so courageously trying to prevent the environmental destruction in their communities. We hear from them how much it matters to them that there are people around the world who are supporting them. I remember a letter that we received that just said in big letters, "You have lifted my spirits today," just because of knowing that people around the world are caring and are expressing their solidarity with the local movement.
Well, I hope members, we think of ourselves as a family here at the Horn, not just community but family. And Paula, I hope members of the Horn family will make contact with Cultural Survival, and that you can in turn pass words on to folks in the Fulbari region, because the opportunity to do something like that, simply to lift spirits, simply to let people know that their cries of "we are here" are being heard as far away as halfway around the globe, is perhaps one of the most important things that we can do. I sincerely agree. And as someone who lives within a few miles of several thousand acres that a coal company from India plans to blow up in Appalachia.
Oh, really?
Really, yes.
With
every lump of coal going back to India, I saw this story and just felt a sense of kinship. So I will be writing my own letter, and I will engage in what advocacy I may, and I sincerely encourage others to do so. And again, the website is culturalsurvival.org, correct?
Yes.
Wonderful. Paula Palmer, I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us this evening. I've kept you a little bit over, but this is as imp- You know, there's a tragedy unfolding in Libya. There's a tragedy unfolding in Japan. And you know what? By my lights, if we can stop one more tragedy from unfolding, we're maybe getting, we're not ahead of the game, but we're at least in it.
Well, I appreciate so much the information that you bring to your listeners and the activism that you're all engaged in, both in your local communities and around the world. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paula. Take care and good luck, and let them know we're with them.
I will do that.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And that is Paula Palmer from Cultural Survival, culturalsurvival.org. I've been looking at the website during the course of our conversation. You can send email. There's a model letter you can follow there. It will cost you nothing to simply let another human being know that you, as a fellow human being, give a damn. Give a damn. That they matter. Inasmuch as you would want to matter to others, you must first let others know that they matter to you. CulturalSurvival.org. The place in Bangladesh is Phulbari, Phulbari. Okay? Yeah. So, it being Friday on the front porch and all, I think it's more than appropriate that we open up the phone lines, don't you? You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email rolls in to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Total Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Total Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got your body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour of the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
A fascinating conversation, I thought. And of critical relevance and importance. Like I said, if we can head off one more humanitarian disaster on the planet, we may not be ahead of the game, but we are at least in it. CulturalSurvival.org, they're doing what some might call God's work. You can find out everything you need to find out about who to write to and where under the Bangladesh portion of the website. They work in Bangladesh. They work in Mexico, Guatemala, Panama, Papua New Guinea, Kenya, Indonesia, the Philippines. They work all over the world. CulturalSurvival.org. Because there's just something right about leaving people alone. Sometimes our bespoke suited betters have to be told no. In fact, I'm reaching the conclusion that most of the time, our bespoke-suited betters need to be told no. So it's 22 minutes past the hour, almost halfway through the program tonight, and we go immediately to the phones. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Sandra, what's up?
The NATO thing. I mean, NATO is, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. It's an organization.
Yeah, I never knew that the Mediterranean was part of the North Atlantic.
Well, it's just sort of, I mean, I understand the sort of need to try to move this along. But I don't know. I don't really see how the U.S. can just disengage. I'm sure they're leading all the ground stuff, right?
We are left holding the bag by agreement on that. But they say, NATO will maintain the no-fly zone, but...
Well, but NATO is, it's an organization that if one is attacked, we all are mantra. You see what I'm saying?
So, right.
it's very, you know, it's all intertwined, and it was an organization established, you know, ostensibly to keep, you know, Germany from rearming. I mean, you know, the history.
Right, and to serve as a buffer, a sort of alliance buffer against the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that was the, you know, but now it's being turned into, I don't know what, because, I don't know, I'm just not, you know, I'm not really feeling this intervention. I find it disturbing, and Syria, hello, what the hell?
You mean people being gunned down and beaten in the streets? And
yeah, I mean, Syria is, you know, it's just all of a sudden, there that place is. So perhaps we should shift to World War III, actually. Maybe we should take that line of thinking.
You mean that they're just little separate set pieces in a larger global conflict?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, because it's, you know, it's starting to look unmanageable, you know, from a hegemon position, I have to say.
It's really... It's hard to argue with that. And you know, maybe that's part of the problem we have is that we tend to view things going forward with an eye looking backward. You know what I mean? So we don't quite know how to define. You know, we know what it looks like after World War I. We knew what it looks like when everybody lined up on one side or the other and started shooting.
Well, we might want to go back to the great powers. I mean, that whole period is so fascinating to me. You know, because of, you know, what was going on. I mean, you know, this could be looking more like that paradigm.
Yeah, that this looks far more like the little power games that were played in the mid to late 19th century sort of thing.
Yeah, you know, with the U.S. flailing about because of its in decline, and the vertical relationships are all disintegrating, and the U.S. is going to have to operate horizontally, which is a great power in decline when you start making those kind of allegiances. And I'm just talking in terms of us as a superpower. You know, you have vertical, which is what it was, you know, say, let's go back to 1990, you know, right after the fall, when the U.S., it was straight up the U.S. and everybody else. But this has flattened considerably, drastically, actually. If I'm making any sense.
No, you are. You are. Trust me.
So the serious thing, though, is interesting, you see. I'm just sort of looking at that and thinking, you know, and I have to say, I am, like, gobsmacked by the bravery of these people, Bob. Don't you think? What the fuck?
Yeah. That kind of goes to my ongoing thesis that nonviolence is a hell of a lot harder than violence. It takes a hell of a lot more courage. You know,
yeah,
for one to go down and another one to take his or her place.
It's incredible. But so now Obama is calling members of Congress. I'm confused. Is that what's going on?
I read that earlier today. You know, phone call here, phone call there.
And so that's supposed to be that is supposed to take the place of the Congress debating issues of war. Now, come on.
And have you noticed that he doesn't want to give a national speech about it?
Well, no. Some people are comparing his presidential style now, brace yourself, to Eisenhower, okay? That's the latest. The hidden hand of the Barack Obama presidency. I'm like, oh, dear Lord. Which is fine, because that's what you have to do. You have to compare presidencies with what we've had, I understand. But we've gone from Hoover to Roosevelt, Kennedy, now Eisenhower. So
they just can't decide which president he is, can they?
Well, the Eisenhower one sort of took me aback. You know, I'm like, yeah, I know Eisenhower was on the golf course. You know, he was cool. I understand. But Eisenhower, though, do you know what the history of Eisenhower is? Come on,
I mean,
I'm just like, are you kidding me with that?
See, you said Eisenhower, Sandra, and my first thought was, you mean the guy that toppled Mohammad Mossadegh and put the Shah back on the peacock throne? That Eisenhower? Yeah, who went in and tried to colonialize, let the CIA try to colonialize Guatemala?
Dulles. I mean, do we have a Dulles lurking in the Obama administration? See, that's scary. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, and if you want to start comparing it like that, yeah, it's really disturbing. But the sort of, this kind of like quiet, the quiet sort of strength of President Obama is just like,
well,
oh.
doesn't that go hand in glove with the no drama image?
Well, that's whatever, but I don't, I mean, I'm not too sure, is that supposed to, you know, make me calm? Are we supposed to understand how he's operating more? Because trust and believe, if he's taking away Miranda rights, I don't expect him to do a farewell speech about the industrial, corporatist, military,
national security complex.
Healthcare complex.
No.
Do you expect that speech?
No. And frankly, one of the reasons for bringing Paula Palmer on a little bit ago was the fact that, and we sort of hit it and blew past it, the fact that the pressure being put up to displace nearly a quarter of a million indigenous human beings in northwestern Bangladesh is coming from the Obama administration, from his ambassador, James Moriarty, who represents apparently not the interests of the United States, but the interests of the 60% American shareholders of global coal management.
Yeah, well, no, and that's, you know, once again, we must continue to frame everything in those terms, because that's the terms that we're operating on now. I saw an interesting piece on Democracy Now! Today. They were talking about the triangle, is it
shirtwaist? Yeah.
Factory. You mentioned Bangladesh, and they were talking about how there was a fire just recently in December where you had people, mostly women, jumping out of the roofs to their death. I mean, it was so similar, it was eerie.
Well, I remember going back years ago, there was a sweater knitting factory.
But this was in December of 2010.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. There's a continuum of these horrors. There was a sweater knitting factory in Bangladesh that just collapsed, period, just pancaked. And
well,
and it was full of working people.
Yeah, well, this fire, a big movement sprouted behind it, up to upward of a million people, but it went nowhere because of the power of Gap, Nike, you know, and all the other corporations who are sort of, because all the garments are made, well, so much of them are made, I forget what the number is out of Bangladesh, but did you realize that these people are getting paid, I think, 48 cents an hour, and it's less in real dollars what those women were paid in 1911?
I know that the wages are
less.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's a third less. And this is globally now, and he also made this other point which just sort of stunned me. He said, if you look at the global economy, the corporations have, like, passed laws. They even have everything imaginable for their copyright protection. I mean, they're back to the max with that. Yet, they cry poverty and destruction of free trade if you try to pass likewise legislation to have a basic living wage across the world.
Right, because that's creeping socialism.
Well, no, but what they have, though, is socialism, which is protecting their copy. You know what I mean? I just thought that was, like, so right on. It's so perfectly true. And if there is no justification, the state is being used to just blatantly support their interests and still try to tell us that it's free trade. And what they're alluding to is that we will all be working for $3 an hour. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, that's the whole goal.
That's really what's coming up.
That's what Ross Perot was talking about when he was talking about that giant sucking sound, and everybody giggled in 1992.
Yeah, and if you take the argument to its logical conclusion, that's what we have. We'll have everyone working for practically nothing, while the corporations have all their intellectual properties backed by law. And I'll use the example of Obama administration wanting to make streaming illegally a felony. Like, you know, the little songs I sent you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you see what I'm saying? They want to make that kind of stuff a felony.
Well, I guess, you know, I don't know. Measure me for the orange jumpsuit.
No, and everybody else. I mean, shit, I'm not even, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Give me a break. Give me a break from that one. But this is where the energies are going, yet and still, it's okay that the clothes we buy from Walmart is made by people who make less money than them poor souls that jumped out the window? I just, you know, it really makes me feel creepy. I'm like, well, how do I function in this society? Because, you know, I can't operate that way anymore. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of, you know, being a party to that sort of global enslavement. And the fact that I have an understanding of it, you know, makes me even feel more culpable, truth be told. And I don't mean to make it into about me, but, you know, I'm just talking about how it's starting to really do my head in, because it's just like, what the F, you know?
Well, it is, and but again, if I dare go back to the theme we've been working, you know, we're talking about things that happened under Bill Clinton. We're talking about things that happened under Poppy Bush, Reagan, George W. Bush, now Obama. And the only thing you can come up with, or at least that I can come up with, is that we're living in a world in which political parties don't matter nearly as much as do the corporations that underpin them.
Well,
and that political philosophy is largely out the window.
No, and it's also, you know, the hypocrisy is just revolting, because if they can have international norms, which they're always trying to promote, controlling copyright, controlling, you know, activity on the internet, domain, you know, all these sort of functional systems that they have internationally, but they cannot address, you know, a labor thing, like having a normalized wage for whatever activity you're doing. Say if you're working in a factory making clothes, we're going to be paid X amount no matter what. And the consumer will just have to, pay a little bit less. And because we're talking about economy of scales, it's not going to be that much more, Bob. This is what I'm talking about. It's like 10 cents more and shit, and to ensure somebody getting a decent wage. We're not talking about huge amounts here. We are talking about lower profits for these pigs. That's the gist of it. Anyway, you know, it always boggles my mind because the solutions are all political. You know what I mean? Because we have the wherewithal to do all this shit.
Well, and the solutions for people, you know, leading everyday day-to-day lives are, I don't know. Shall we be paranoid and say that they are deliberately made difficult? You know, how do you go out and find a garment, for God's sakes, a T-shirt, and know that it was made by someone who is taking a living wage home?
Well, that's the thing. We obviously we can. So I'm just saying, it's just, but the solutions, you know, it's not that far. It's not that difficult to do. I mean, for example, when the garment industry was going full effect in the U.S., where the clothes were being made for the citizens to wear, I mean, they eventually got to a point where working standards were tolerable. Oh, but as soon as that happens, no, we can go over here where it's not tolerable so we can make more profits. I mean, you know, it's just sick.
Well, remember though, that this isn't happening in a vacuum, Sandra, and it's not happening by accident. These are all sort of the poisonous fruit of the wet dreams of Milton Friedman. Because it's not a secret. Go, you know, you can go and read Milton Friedman, and this is the world that he wanted. This was his dream, where the worker lives in constant desperation, utter abject misery and fear, and the market drives something drives a machine that is concerned only with making profit, in which there are no ethics, there are no morals, and there are no concerns about human rights. And when you talk about your NAFTA and your GATT and your various and sundry free trade agreements, every last one of them are posited on those principles, are they not?
Yeah, no, it's incredible, but it's all coming home to roost on us, though, because I'm not lying. If they get rid of the collective bargaining and, you know, destroy the public unions like they're working hard to do, there's nothing going to be stopping wages from just falling through the floor in everywhere. And these white-collar people, you know, it's just, you're next. That's the thing that always kills me, too, is that everyone ain't safe. I don't, you know, maybe, I don't know.
Well, you know, by way of example of what you just said, I just thought of something. I read David Sirota's book, what was it called, The Uprising, a couple of years ago, and he had a chapter on trying to organize among workers at Microsoft. And one of the reasons they resisted joining a union was because they didn't want to feel like they were, you know, those kind of people that would, you know, join a union.
Because they weren't, you know, they
were, right, they were associates. They weren't just somebody's workers.
Right. No, that's
no, you're next. And they're learning that.
No, it's crazy because there's a reason that collective bargaining is on the UN Declaration of Human Rights. You know what I'm saying?
It's right.
Sort of. I just think that you know, it just can't be a sort of unimaginable notion. People need to really understand what the hell it means. Anyway, the only other thing I wanted to mention was I know I sent you those emails from Japan. You know, just because I was just gobsmacked. I'm like. 10,000 times more. Hello?
Yeah.
Well, and then all, and at the same time.
And the guy says, we think this may because there might be a leak.
No, but the other thing is that the constant sort of, oh, there's radiation here, there, and everywhere, but it doesn't hurt anyone. Aren't you sick of that? I don't believe, you know, how
well,
are we supposed
who's,
to believe?
Who's being told that and actually believes it? Because
well,
I think
I
you
mean,
have to live under a bell jar in order to buy into that stuff.
I mean, because it's just incredible. It's like, you know, that dude on TV from Japan looking iller by the day talking about, oh, you know, maybe you shouldn't drink water. And then all the water sells out, which is fair enough. But, you know, I'm just sort of, are we looking at a potential China syndrome, if I may invoke that movie?
Yeah, or what they call core on the floor.
Shut the hell! I mean, I don't even know why I'm laughing. It's horrible. It's
well, it is, but yes, we are, and again, it's those guys in the bespoke Savile Row suits who have some sort of vested profit-driven interest in making sure that nobody rises up and starts, you know, pointing fingers at them.
Well, no, but the thing is, though. It just looks like, just from the reports that I'm sort of reading here and there, that the area is getting wider and wider.
Oh yeah, those little concentric circles, red then yellow then yeah.
Yeah, it's getting bigger and bigger. And the thing is, I was looking at the map of Japan, and damn, I didn't realize that whole complex was so damn close to Tokyo. And as I had mentioned before. How do you relocate 13 million people again?
Yeah, see, that's not going to work. and there are some people, at least, who are beginning to pay attention because I saw some reportage today on the electric TV box in which some legislator was on the screen with questions about the safety of Indian Point in New York. Because Indian Point is 50 miles from New York City.
Well, yeah, that would be a one and done, wouldn't it, for New York?
Well, yeah, it would. I mean, those concentric circles you were talking about coming out away from Fukushima Daiichi.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one circle for Indian Point, and New York's in it. And
well,
they're talking about the fact that the thing leaks constantly.
Yeah, I mean, I heard that Cuomo is desperate to close it. I mean, it's sort of something that he would love to take care of now.
Well,
that's scary.
Well, yeah, and if he wants to close it or starts trying to close it, then my only advice to Andrew Cuomo is stay off small aircraft.
Well, and not only that, but I heard the reactor in Vermont, they tried to close it, and the fucking regulatory commission came in and said, no,
yeah,
we're
going
to extend it. I'm like, wait a minute. Wow. So that kind of freaked me out, you know.
And that's what you're, you know, because remember the nuclear, and again, it's one of those things that you just have to confront if you're going to live in a reality-based world in the United States. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has no interest in regulation. They have no interest in their damn mission. They are a support system for the profit-driven nuclear power industry.
Well, yeah, wasn't it created to manage? Yeah. I mean, its origins is all about partnership with the industry. There is no regulating from the get. But it's interesting that they overrode a legislator, legislative body, to extend some old ass reactor another 20 years. I was stunned by that.
And so, you know, I don't. How long do we dodge bullets?
I really don't know, and I don't know if we are. If this shit in Japan, that stuff seems like it might be global. If it keeps, it seems to be going from bad to worse. I don't know. Listen, you know, I'm always prone to hyperbolics, but I am a bit worried about this one since I am in California.
Well, you've kind of got a right to be.
But also, I have to ask you, what about that Massey decision, man?
Oh, that sucks.
Okay, I read that. That ain't no joke. You might want to explain it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the backgrounder on that is basically there was a lawsuit that was held in circuit court that sought medical monitoring for people who had gone to school or worked in or worked around the old Marsh Fork Elementary School because it was, you know, less than 300 feet from a toxic coal silo. There was dust all over the place. It is a toxic waste site.
Yeah, the picture was like the silo. I'm like, oh no.
Well, and in the back, and understand, Sandra, in the background of that mountain in the background.
Yeah,
that's not a mountain.
That's shit.
That is an earthen dam, 400 feet behind the school that holds back 2.8 billion gallons of liquid toxic waste.
Oh God. Wow.
And so the jury came back and handed down a verdict in Massey's favor. And I don't know, it may have been some combination of bad lawyering on the plaintiff's side, but it also has to do with the fact that the judicial system in West Virginia is every bit as corrupt as every other governmental entity in West Virginia. Okay? It wholly and utterly corrupt. Remember, this is a trial that was being had in the same county where a nonviolent protester was subjected to something on the order of a $200,000 bond when, on the same day that a child rapist was let out on a $5,000 bond.
Well, priorities, Bob, priorities.
Ain't that the truth?
Oh, man, well, yeah, but... Yeah. So is that case, can that case be appealed? What court was it in?
It was in the circuit court, and yeah, it can be appealed to the West Virginia Supreme Court. The likelihood of success is probably somewhere between slim and none, because there are coal whores on the West Virginia Supreme Court, too. So, but if there's anything to be said for it, it is that individual claims for personal injury arising from proximity to that thing, they're not foreclosed, but certainly Massey lawyers would use the decision as an argument to say, hey, you know, Judge, we've already been through this. We proved there wasn't nothing wrong with their Marsh Fork Elementary. See there, look. But this is an ongoing problem in West Virginia. Very few people know this story either. You know, Bobby Kennedy and his associates went into, I believe, either Harrison or Wood County, West Virginia, up in the northern part of the state, and they got a massive verdict against some corporate polluters. Because they had done massive corporate polluting.
Right.
And the circuit judge then turned around and cut the verdict and cut the lawyer's fees deliberately. Because, as it was explained to me, what that means is that no plaintiff's lawyer is going to go to the expense of bringing a suit like that in West Virginia again. That this place is just going to be turned into a toxic corporate polluter wasteland and wonderland at the same time.
Where people have to live, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it really is too much. I just, you know, like I said, I just saw that story and I thought, man, you know, it's just, it's kind of nonstop. Hey, did you hear that, Bob Herbert's leaving the New York Times?
No.
Yeah, I was really.
Is he going to get out? Is he going to get out from behind the paywall?
Well, see, I thought it was interesting that he said he's kind of tired of the deadlines and the 800 word form of the articles, whatever gibberish they come up with. But yeah, so he's leaving. I'm not too sure when it is, but I was just kind of taken aback because, you know, I always am in awe of when I read his stuff because it's so different from the other stuff on that page.
Miles of difference.
So I don't know what.
I can't imagine Bob Herbert and the Thomas Friedman existing in the same building.
Oh, exactly. And also, I mean, who are they going to replace him with? I hope it's not that Blow person because he's another one of those, you know, chastising black people all the time. I'm not really feeling him, but who knows?
I know, but
you know. But also, you know, I'm like, damn. So, but then again, I got my little free subscription until 2012. So.
Yeah. Quit bragging.
Anyway, listen, I know you probably have other people. I'll let you go on.
All right, Sandra, you have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Bye now.
Take care. Bye.
From California, that is our buddy Sandra. And it's about 10 minutes before the hour. Yeah, that was not inspiring, what happened in the circuit court today in West Virginia. Yeah. Hey, you know, so what if they poisoned you? You know, it was a jury of six people. So-called tried and true. In southern West Virginia, getting somebody who doesn't know about Massey Energy onto a jury and doesn't know the power that they wield, it's kind of like jury selection for the O.J. trial, if you know what I mean. Let's keep things rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
Where to start? So much.
Oh, I know.
So much happening. I'll start with something because I was telling you this weeks ago about how LePage would do anything, and you can see that with the mural. I'll just say this: if you want to start up an interesting conversation, so they're going to take down the mural. So what do you think they're going to replace that with? More corporate history murals, probably.
I wondered, you know, I figured just blank panels. You know, the first thing I thought of, though, when I saw that the murals were coming down was back when John Ashcroft poured some Crisco over his head and declared that the naked booby of the Statue of Justice was offensive to Christian morals and covered it up with a $10,000 curtain for 8 years.
Well, you know, the question they should be asking, Bob, is this. Are the people really offended? Because I haven't heard anything offensive.
No.
So who cares what the governor thinks?
Well, beyond that, I mean, you're in Maine, David. Is there any sort of ongoing query or curiosity about who the secret admirer who was afraid that the building in Augusta, Maine had become reminiscent of North Korea? Is there any curiosity about who that person is? Or do people just say, you know, LePage made it up like he makes everything else up?
Well, you know, it was probably somebody on the LePage staff, and this is just another way to, you know, he wants to piss off liberals in Maine. That's his goal. He wants to, so when someone comes out and says, this isn't politically motivated, well, we know what that means.
That it is.
I can't help but think what would happen if, the Democrats decided like, we don't want this corporation here, and, we're closing it down, so you can leave now. What would the reaction be there? I mean, and this is a mural, for God's sakes, and nobody really looks at it anyways.
Well, look, destroying art is, it comes from the same sick, lizard brain impulse that burning books comes from, David.
Oh, I know.
And maybe that's the failure of messaging up there. This is no different than LePage if he wanted to burn books. He's a book burner. He's an art destroyer.
Well, I think the other thing is that when you have this tendency to, and it doesn't seem to pan out, slightly as you think it does when it comes to cutting funding. You know, for years, people in Maine and Maine and elsewhere have been saying they're going to cut funding. They're going to cut funding, and then it doesn't pan out that year. And then people think of it as like a boy cries wolf type of scenario. And now we're witnessing funding being drastically cut, and everybody's going around looking like, oh, that's no big deal.
And they just think things are going to go. I mean, but the mural thing, I mean, is anybody paying attention to framing up there? And I don't mean for the mural.
yeah.
But I mean, in terms of this guy's going to spend state money to take the murals down, and the things cost $400,000 to begin with. So how is that fiscally sound? Is anybody asking those questions up there?
Well, you know, the thing about it is that when you look at something like this, and I don't see my point is this, is that if he does take the mural down, then the Democrats should move on that and campaign on why he's taking the mural down instead of just say, well, he took the mural down because of this, and try to get the point across that this is like a cultural revisionism in the worst way.
Well, it absolutely is, and it could also be tied to education budgets. You know, what about art instruction in Maine public schools? Are they being cut too? You know, so you begin asking questions.
You know the answer to that one.
Well, hell yes.
Yeah.
So the question immediately presents itself: what does Paul LePage have against art? There's a million ways to approach this.
I mean, all of this is just creeping to they want collapse on a state-to-state scale when it comes to government, just to point out and say, look how much it's failed. Well, that's because you took the funding away, dumbasses.
Yeah, you made it fail.
And it's funny because when we look at what's happening with the announcement today, you know, what they said about Scott Walker and someone sending him an email about the false flag thing.
Yeah, oh, and the guy who did that also turned out to be a racist, by the way, in case you were wondering.
I'm not surprised by that.
Who would?
But I can definitely see something happening like that where the Republicans are that desperate.
Sure.
Someone taking a shot at someone grazing a politician who's a flacky, a no-name, just a parent.
Well, you know, the thing is, I think the main reason that the Walker people didn't take the idea to heart probably has to do with the fact that they couldn't find somebody that they wouldn't get caught as having planted an agent provocateur. Mm. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because labor knows its own. And labor's not going to do it, and they couldn't find a patsy. They couldn't find, you know, they couldn't find an Oswald, and so that's why they didn't do it.
You know, the funniest thing about this, Bob, is these are the dumbest things, and yet they're working. In terms of their strategies, they're working. The dumbest things. You know, when I went into the post office today to mail some things, I was just witnessing two people. In my state, in my city, and they weren't discussing the mural, they weren't discussing any of this. They were discussing American Idol.
Of course. Of course.
It's one thing after the other where it's all connected.
This is not an engaged populace. I mean, what we're doing, the conversations that we have, David, and the people who like to be part of listening or offering their own ideas by email, phone calls, whatever, is a smaller chunk of the body politic. Most of the people, most of America, sadly, would prefer to come home, open an old Milwaukee, plop on the couch, and see who really sucks tonight on American Idol.
Yeah, I understand completely that sentiment. And I think that, when you look at what these, corporations are putting out this cultural poison by the gallons, people, by the gallons now. And here's the other thing. I brought this up before, Bob, but I'm going to say it again because people need to understand this. It's not just happening in America, it's happening worldwide. Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader has 84 different versions. And when I say 84 different versions...
I didn't know there were 84 Jeff Foxworthies.
But see, that's what I'm talking about. It's just cultural poison, and we just accept it, and we say, yeah, we'll just put it on the air. And you wonder, and you're like, so anyone can put anything on the air now, and there's no consequences, there's nothing? And any country now? And I guess so, because 84 different versions of Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader. This is one show, where they take this stupid concept, and they just clone it everywhere else and make everyone else stupider.
Well, you know, I go back to Malloy's thesis that TV is designed to make you forget. And it makes you forget the world outside. It makes you forget that you're crippled with debt. It makes you forget. And instead of being out and being active in your community, you can compare yourself to a fifth grader. And, you know, that's better, for our corporate betters, that, you know, the bespoke suited gang,
mm-hmm.
That's better for them. It's better for them because we're watching their ads.
Oh, I agree. Yeah.
And we're not out making our communities better.
You know, you brought up Malloy, and I was just interested in your take on last night, even more so. Malloy is just saying, no more Obama. And I don't know if you heard that. You were listening to that email that he read. I was like, wow, he's going to get even more of this.
Well, there's a manifest degree of frustration with Barack Obama, and I'm one of those who is frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'm not the shell answer man. I don't propose to tell people what to do or how to think. But, you know, I know that it's going to be Barack Obama or somebody that makes Barack Obama look eminently reasonable. Okay?
Yeah.
There is not going to be a choice in 2012 of someone, at least not someone who's going to win, mind you. There's
right.
not going to be a choice between Barack Obama and someone better than Barack Obama. It's going to be Barack Obama and somebody exponentially worse. You know, Tim Pawlenty? You know, he's the most reasonable one in the pack right now.
Yeah.
And the guy's a loon. You know, Mitt Romney, Willard Romney. Oh, spare me. And then there's did you see this story? You know, and I hate even telling stories about her anymore. Did you see this thing about the Mussolini's visit to India?
I heard about it.
She went to India. The United States Department of State asked the Indian government to upgrade her to a diplomatic status so that she would have handlers and stuff, and the Indian government said, come on! What? And so Mussolini, Caribou Barbie, what have you, spent 4 days inside her own hotel room. Really. You know, you go to India, how do you not get out on the street? How do you not, you know, go and Jesus, how do you not? One
she
hotel
was
is
the
just.
Bomb people.
One,
she couldn't
right,
shoot any cows.
Right. She didn't have her machine guns with her or her helicopter, and she couldn't just shoot people out of her way, and they talked funny, and their English was better than hers.
Oh, yeah.
But they were brown and terrifying. And so she locked herself in her hotel room for 4 days in India and refused to interact with the staff. That was the part that, I mean, not even so much as, I mean, what did she do when the maids came? Just hung the do not disturb sign out and didn't let them change the sheets? I mean, really?
So she didn't go to India for any lecture or nothing?
No, she went to give a speech, and that's what she did. That was part of the diplomatic request, so that they could have, you know, cars and motorcycles with sirens and stuff, so that she wouldn't have to, you know, have any contact with those people. And it was, but she went and she gave her speech and she went and locked herself back in the room until it was time for, like, you know, put her in a suitcase and sneak her on the plane. Jesus, you know, or the, you know, the trip to Israel where she, you know, I need to go to Bethlehem to see where my Lord and Savior was born, right?
Mm-hmm.
So her people didn't set it up with the Israeli government, nothing. And so they set out in the morning. It was the first stop on her tour. And they get to the checkpoint there because, well, you know, Bethlehem's in the West Bank. Bethlehem is part of Palestine, not Israel.
Mm.
And they and the car pulls up short of the checkpoint. And apparently the Godzilla from Wasilla has some sort of a hissy. And the car turns around and she goes back and hides in the hotel again.
So
this is what you're facing when you're talking about the choices arrayed against Barack Obama. You know, Newt Gingrich, David? You know,
I agree with you on a lot of the things about...
So, you know, I understand, and I don't want to piss anybody off, but, you know, what are you going to do in December 2012? Sit it out? Well, it worked. You know, there was a lot of people who sat out Wisconsin. How did that work?
Hmm. But I guess what I'm saying is, singularly, if I don't vote for Obama, I'm saying because of I know how the masses will react, they'll vote for Obama in droves. I think this reaction of when people say, you're not going to vote for Obama, I mean, I think a lot of it is emotional. And it's really, I mean, it's kind of pointless because most people, let's face it, are going to vote for Obama because that's the choice in front of them.
You know, now we've got, oh my God, Michelle Bachmann added into the mix.
And yeah, we can tell how phony that one is.
You know, and she's, and it was, as it was pointed out on my Facebook page, she's just going to answer questions during the pageants. You know, they call them debates, but they're pageants. She's just going to answer questions there by using her CNC. You know, the Savior says moo.
You know, it'll be interesting to see how much time. I really hope they don't give her that much time. But knowing this media, good Lord, how you wonder how much time they're going to give her before she announces, you know what, I don't want to be president. I was just kidding with you.
I was only exploring my fundraising abilities, and now that I've fundraised, I'm done exploring. I found
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. One last thing I wanted to mention was I just saw the I recommend it to everyone. I rented the Bill Withers documentary.
Oh wow!
And he talks about
West Virginia guy, Bill.
Right. West Virginia, and he talks about his upbringing. And he one of the most revealing aspects is he talks about his stuttering problem as a kid, and he said he was always considered worthless. And he's always struggled this with all his life because all of his teachers were the same thing. They would say, what's wrong with you? Why can't you do these things? Spit it out, man. So one of the things how he coped with that was he kept the dreams to himself. And while he was working at Weber and various other places in factories, he would always hold these dreams to himself, but he wouldn't tell anyone. So that's why it was always that's why it was a big surprise when Bill Withers became this big superstar. So one of the scenes in the film that's really, really moving is he goes to this foundation they set up for stuttering children, and he starts talking about his problems and how they can overcome these problems and not to hide the fact that they stutter and don't think you're stupid or anything like that. And for anyone who wants to see a really amazing documentary, I mean, it even deals with the fact of he hasn't put music out for 20 years, and they talks about he has this whole studio set up, and they play a few songs that are just like basic works that he's working on, and he pretends that he's not working on anything, and you hear from his family members, and they go around different areas of West Virginia. And it's just a really, really, really moving documentary. So if people want to check it out, it's called Still Bill, and it's on the life of Bill Withers. And it's just impressive. I mean, for anyone who wants to spend like 78 minutes, it's just a good viewing experience.
Cool. I always appreciate your reviews and suggestions for viewing because far more often than not, they pan out to be something really, really good.
Well, I mean, you know, it's Bill Withers, and the great thing about it is you get to see, like, the story. stories behind the songs. Like, there's an interview he does with Cornel West and Tavis Smiley, and they start talking about black history and the struggles combined with their ethnicity and the fact of Bill Withers at that time, how he was growing up. And like I said, it's just, to me, the movie is like one big quotable.
Cool. Well, I may try to have a look. And well, I'm sure other folks will as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will be really interested to check that out. But that's what I got for the night.
Awesome. David, thank you very kindly, and have a great evening.
All right, later.
All right, bye. With all that talk of Bill Withers, I can't resist running one of my favorite Bill Withers tunes. We'll be right back. I'm not going anywhere. Just a little interlude, going straight back to the phones.
My friend, yeah, feel is there a point to do today? They keep trying to tell me
that was one of the most perfect marriages of music and lyric, because that it's dysfunctional and the man, funky, and it, what a story. Because I think one of the reasons that was a hit was because so many people could identify with that idea of being in a toxic relationship that just felt a little too good to get out of, just even though, yeah. Quick email in from our buddy Joe Ray. Hey, Bob. I was going to give you a break from my twisted observations, but you brought up Palin's vacation. See what I do? I don't think there's any need to speculate why she would spend all her time in a hotel in India. She knows Rush, and that means she has all the safe contacts to buy little boys and girls, or rent, that is. They say you can't buy love, but you sure can rent it by the hour. Following the Republican ideology of guilt by association, she must have been having private time with some 14-year-old slave children. Well, says Joe Ray, if you can keep that mental image at bay, then have a good weekend. Oh, Jesus, Joe. But, you know, she's a pig-licking. And those people are they've all got some kind of closet. Some kind of closet somewhere. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Brother Bob.
Hey, Cossack, you're back, brother.
Yeah, just wanted to finish off that thought and throw a couple more at you.
Okie doke.
Here's the thing. First of all, do you know what the literacy rate was in Libya when Gaddafi took over in 69?
No.
10%. Oof. You know what it is now?
No.
90%. They don't mention the fact that Gaddafi provides free health care, subsidized food, housing.
Well, that shit's got to go.
Cheap gasoline. Most of his people own their own homes. Now you see why we're fighting Gaddafi. I mean, the man is twisted. I have no doubt of that. Okay. Tell me who of the leaders out there isn't. You mean Berlusconi is a moral model for the world?
Hardly.
Or how about Sarkozy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Brain works that way.
Oh, by the way, goodbye Stephen Harper in Canada. Yeah, I guess you saw that news.
No, I missed.
Yeah, there was a Canadian parliamentary vote of no confidence today. That right-wing jackass in Canada who wanted to change the laws so that Fox could come in and set up Fox Broadcast in Canada.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gone.
Oh, good.
There will be elections in May for our neighbors to the north.
Thank God for minor miracles.
There's no doubt. Trying to engage in some sort of comparative analysis of despotic assholes is not going to lead us to any sort of salutary conclusions about why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, no. What I'm saying, though, is, first of all, unfortunately, and you will have to admit this, that most Americans are, by definition, ignorant.
Oh, geopolitically ignorant? Absolutely. And ignorant of their own system? Certainly. The Newsweek, that Newsweek quiz that Susan and I went over a few nights ago is a case in point. And the folks who host the National Geographic people who host the Geography Bee,
mm-hmm.
you know, every year they introduce a story as they introduce the Geography Bee saying, you know, most people can't find their own town on a map. And it's true. You know, it takes you back to, who was that, that Bimbet? You know who I'm talking about. Doggone it. One of the beauty pageants. The great, I'll find it here in a second because, yeah, here it is. In a nutshell, I'm sure you remember this. This is What's Wrong with America? Miss Teen USA.
Okay. Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have that, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Need we say more?
I don't know.
That
I just
she is or probably still is, was at the time, an extraordinarily beautiful young woman.
No.
And it's obvious that culturally speaking, every effort had been put into her outward appearance, and nothing had been put into her brain. And that's America in a nutshell, Cossack.
Well, then again, in my case, I guess I was a little bit more conscious of geopolitics and the map and so forth, because growing up was the era of decolonialization, and you watched Africa day by day as these European colonies just changed their name, disappeared, and there were new colonies.
Well, yeah, and you know, you're a little bit older than me, but the same thing happened with me because I had a World War II veteran father, and my World War II veteran father would sit on his lap when I was a little boy, and he would get the Rand McNally Atlas out because he had been fascinated, because when he came back from all over the South Pacific, places that he would never see again, when he came back. He had occasion to travel all over the country, starting in Bremerton, Washington, as he and his buddies made their way back to their various and sundry homes. And so my dad would sit there looking at the map of the United States, and he'd say, "Let's go to Arizona," and he'd flip a couple of pages past Alabama, then Alaska, then Arkansas. Bang, Arizona, and he'd point, and he'd say, there it is, son, Douglas, Arizona. One of my best friends in the world lives in Douglas, Arizona. And he'd show me Pocatello, Idaho, and he'd show me Cincinnati, Ohio, and on and on, and the map became a way of traveling.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing today. I find myself doing, you know, my father would have lost his mind over Google Earth.
Oh, God, yes.
And I do the same thing with Ferg, you know, and we zoom down. One day I zoomed way in deep on Rome, and I showed Ferg exactly the walk that Julius Caesar took on the Ides of March, 44 B.C., and I showed him how the neighborhood in Rome where the Theater of Pompey stood still carries the outline of the Theater of Pompey. And I showed him, and then we zoomed in, and we found photographs, and I said, right there, son, right there. And at this point, you know, Ferg's mouth is just like, wow, Dad. And so he's interested,
yeah.
because inadvertently, I'm making it real. On the other hand, you know, I've got little grandchildren who watch Dora the Explorer. And there's that song about, I'm the map, I'm the map, I'm the map. And again, trying to get people interested in maps. And because, you know, if you are, there's at least a passing chance, Cossack, that you won't hate people just for not being where you're from.
Yeah.
Which really is a big chunk of not winding up in misadventures in places like Libya.
True. Oh, and another thing, by the way, just to touch on Libya again. Even though that Libyan was convicted of the bombing at Lockerbie, if you will remember, at the time, the initial assumption was that this was actually an Iranian plot, and that's what they said, it was an Iranian plot to get back at the U.S. for their blowing up Flight 655, the Iranian airliner, if you remember. And they awarded the captain for shooting down a passenger airliner.
Kind of forgot that.
All 290 people died. And this was like 5 months before the Lockerbie bombing. Who do you think had a bigger motive to do something about it? You think? Maybe?
Yeah.
And that's what they initially said. And then for some reason, geopolitically, it was better to leave the Iranians alone and go after Gaddafi. That's how these things happen. And America is the United States of amnesia.
Well, you can forgive Muammar Gaddafi if he thinks he's going to get through this one just fine, because he's gotten through all of the others just fine.
Yeah.
And you know what? I would say that there is a better than even chance that Muammar Gaddafi dies quietly in his bed several years hence.
Very good possibility, I think.
Yeah.
It's really bizarre. We don't seem to understand, A, how many people really know diddly squat about Gaddafi, about his country, how things happen. History, how these things happen.
I know.
Oh, and to touch on our brilliant dear leader in Maine. There's a wonderful quote that belongs in his mouth, which is, whenever I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun. you know who said
offhand,
that?
I've heard that, but offhand, no.
Goering.
Oh, Jesus.
Hermann Goering.
Yeah, who was busy socking away as much culture in caves in Germany as he possibly could, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. And the quote that you touched on, that's by Heine, about that was but a prelude. Where they burn books, they will ultimately burn people also.
Ooh. And yeah, I hold to my thesis that burning art is the same as burning books.
Yeah. And I mean, good Lord, like you said, what are they going to replace these things with? Corporate logos? Are they going to go out and be the senator from...
Well, maybe, let's see what. Maybe the L.L. Bean logo could go there. I don't know what else is in Maine. I'm ignorant.
Well, there are still,
The Bath Ironworks, maybe?
Yeah.
The Bath Shipyards? Sure, why not?
But, I mean... Are they going to be the senator from Massey?
We've already got those.
Yeah, but are they going to be honest enough to call them that?
Most people, Cossack, do not want to be confronted with that reality. They might even go so far as to privately hold that opinion, but they don't want to say it out loud because it just feels too icky. Yeah, complex geopolitical word there. Icky. Hey, Cossack, I got to roll on, brother, but good follow-up. I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.
Here, have a nice weekend.
You too, brother. Bye now.
All right. Bye.
27 minutes past the hour. We will roll on. A reminder, we're still trying to get into the 50s. We're at 60. We're still trying to get into the 50s as we try to make the March fundraising goal. We are only 60 $10 contributions away. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. The tab is Contribute. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob. It's Preston.
Well, hey, Preston. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I wanted to thank you for that interview you did with the person from Cultural Survival.
Yes, Paula Palmer.
Yes.
Further proof of the good work that goes on in a great place like Boulder, Colorado.
You know, I didn't realize that's where they're based. I actually thought they were east somewhere.
No, their cultural survival is in Boulder.
Okay, right on. Yeah, and I visited their website, and great.
Isn't it amazing? I mean, just what stunningly good work they do.
Yep. And excellent.
You know, I've got to go back there after the show's over because I saw a link that said, Save Sacred Sites in Mexico. Whoa, mm-hmm. I got to know about that. Because, you know, I'm such a pre-Columbian, prehistory geek.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, speaking of cultural things and how sometimes they can be so ugly and used against us. The cultural poison that David spoke of so well. The gallons and gallons of it, for sure. But there are sort of cultural, I don't know, antidotes maybe, but truth serums maybe, I don't know. But one that comes to mind is that film Avatar, which I think deserves a lot of critiques and criticisms and stuff, but in the main I thought it was, you know, that piece of kind of science fiction had a lot of documentary going on in it. I mean, this assault on indigenous people from, you know, the well-armed people who wanted to do what? Mine their land for unobtainium was the mineral they used.
Right.
Are you familiar with that? I Wikipedia'd that term, and actually it's actually used in the mining industry.
Really? I mean, I thought that was just a word that James Cameron made up.
I thought so too, but apparently it's like a term that means something that is very rare and hard to get at. If I'm remembering.
Also, it's just sort of a generic term of art.
Mm-hmm. Well, he applied it then as well. I don't know. You have to Wikipedia it. I also Wikipedia'd Avatar itself, and that has multiple meanings, different sorts of meanings in different contexts. Apparently Avatar has something to do with Hinduism. I don't know.
Yeah, well, yeah, an avatar is a symbolic representation of some spiritual force. It's not an icon per se.
Yeah.
That's in many ways that's why that's why the word has gotten such coin, especially as the internet has expanded, because if you're on Twitter or Facebook, you've got an avatar.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's not you, but it embodies something that you think about you.
Mm. Yeah. So, quickly back to the actual movie Avatar. A lot of things that I appreciated about it. I've been going to this Unitarian church here in Denver, and my pastor brought it up in the context of a sermon about respect. And he said something like, there's this scene in Avatar where when they greet each other, they kind of bow in a way, and they say, I see you.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Well, you know, the thing that struck me when I saw that film, not to cut you off, and we'll consider, don't let me take us down the garden path.
Okay.
But there was, that is actually a cultural, if there's any truth to be had from Hollywood, that was not the first movie to use that phrase. Okay. There was a Rock Hudson movie from like the late 1940s or late 1950s probably. It was a color film. I only recall seeing it as a kid. But it takes place somewhere in Polynesia. And Rock Hudson played the noble white man doing whatever noble white men do. And there was this charming and adorable and whatever old indigenous person, and it had something to do with leper colonies, but his greeting to Rock Hudson was always, I see you.
Okay.
And it meant, you know, I acknowledge your presence and your worth and your partness of everything that is around you, and it's very profound. to the same extent that Robert A. Heinlein, the great science fiction writer, once wrote that in the far north, in the, among the Inuit, they don't say goodbye, that they say sometime again.
Nice. And what's adios? Isn't that go with God or
something? Yeah, go from God or yeah.
Okay. And you were talking earlier about the importance of seeing people in other countries as human beings and not just the U.S. exceptionalism and the kind of supremacist attitudes in so many ways. But when someone actually goes there and sees them, it's a joy. And I saw Andrew Zimmern was in Syria recently.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah. And again, a cultural something to counter the poison. You know, what he's doing, I think, is very humane, progressive, radical in a sense. So anyway, just the connections he's making and the cultures that he's sharing and respecting. So anyway, actually some friends of mine lived in Syria for a year themselves. They were teaching there and it was a pretty fantastic experience. So anyway.
Well, I've just found a new use for the word unobtainium.
Okay.
Ron in Raleigh just wrote in and he said, I've been using that term for years to apply to my attempt to get parts for my 1990 Volkswagen Corrado. It's a rare car of which less than 20,000 were sold. So, you know, whenever Ron needs an anise flag to mesh with his flagellate, basically he's in search of unobtainium.
Okay, great. Well, what else?
Well, I think if there is a follow up, and I'm glad you're giving me the opportunity to do this, if there is a follow up to be had for the conversation with Paula Palmer, it is that people please do something that is incredibly easy to do, and get letters out. There's even sample letters on the website at culturalsurvival.org. Get letters out to officials and emails to officials in Bangladesh and your local make your voice heard. And I think there's even a contact form there where, as Paula Palmer said, they can convey messages to the indigenous peoples there to say, hey, look, you know, somebody in Colorado, somebody in Washington, somebody in Appalachia actually knows you exist and cares and is to the extent that they may humanly possibly be, they're in this struggle on your side.
Yes, right on. And, I'd love to see the solidarity that Paula was talking about, kind of that international solidarity networking taking place. I'd love to see it extend even more so over the airwaves, the internet,
yeah.
Programs like this.
I'd like to, but I'd also like to see it in its physical form. I think, because I think we have so much to learn from one another. And this is not me just wanting to go and be, some horse's ass global tourist. I'd love, because one of the things that drives me crazy about travel, Preston, is that you go somewhere for 2 days, you have no idea where you are, and then you come back.
Mm-hmm.
I think we would do so well with cultural exchange programs, especially among peoples who are being put upon by these global profit-driven death merchants. They just are. We would benefit in Appalachia manifestly by having the energies and the different perspective, say, of someone from Bangladesh come to the Coal River Valley. And it would be equally beneficial to send someone from maybe an affected Alaskan village where they're about to have their way of life destroyed by a coal mine on the Chuitna River, and send them to Bangladesh, and send somebody from Illinois to the Black Mesa in Arizona and send somebody from the Black Mesa to Mongolia, where Peabody coal is going to destroy those cultures. You know, ultimately we're talking, these are extinction issues, Preston.
Yeah, definitely.
And there is no culture on earth, and I know this rubs the right wing the wrong way, but you know what doesn't? There is no such thing as cultural superiority. There is no one culture that is better or more worthwhile than another. The fact that one culture develops massive and varied ways in which to slaughter other cultures is not some sort of grand passage of holy writ upon the validity of the culture of the culture that can do all the killing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is worth in peoples who. There's worth in people who whose lives are pastoral or forest based,
are artful, like in I think Bali, Indonesia. Their whole culture is like a lot of art. That's their emphasis, and gardens. And
you know, the world. Who can say when in time or where in the world we might need the basket-making technology of some peoples from northwest Bangladesh.
Right.
And who is to say that they don't have a right to continue cultivating species of rice that they have done for 5,000 years instead of something generated by Monsanto? No one has the right to do that. These are fundamental issues of self-determination. And when you tell people that what's under your ground is more important than you who live on it, you've eliminated all concepts of self-determination. Wow. Let me climb down off the soapbox real quick.
No, I appreciate it, that. And what you're saying about cultural exchange and the need for them, that reminded me of something that happened just today. Sometimes when I'm at work, I do hear the discussions of American Idol and a lot of stuff like that, and sometimes I'm concerned about how much space those sorts of discussions take up. I can understand the appeal of that stuff to a degree, but anyway, I think oftentimes though, underneath that surface stuff, there's so many interesting things to discover about people, not just in other parts of the world, but just in other parts of our office, you know, or workspace.
So true. So true.
So what happened was I heard you play Down Presser Man last night.
Yeah, wasn't that awesome?
I loved it. And I reposted it on Facebook. And then I looked up, I Wikipedia'd Down Presser Man, and it took me to this song called Sinner Man. And apparently Down Presser Man's kind of originated with that song, and it's this African spiritual that goes back a while. And Nina Simone did a version of it that it was stunning.
And, I've got a story here, and just bear with me for a second because it's worth telling. While I was down in Mississippi, there was a man there, and he had lived his life, and then he had come back to where he came from, and it was South Carolina. And he found out because he was sort of driven on this quest of personal enlightenment. He followed his family tree, and very similar to Alex Haley going all the way back into Africa, he was able to as well, and he was able to by virtue of a song, Preston. And it was later verified that his grandmother, and they had preserved the song. His grandmother, I believe I'm telling the story correctly, and I think I've got it on disc somewhere. But this song, his grandmother knew it, and one other woman on the planet knew it.
Mm.
And she was a grandmother in an African village. And it was a very specific song, and it was a song that only the women sang at the time of a funeral. And it almost had the quality of a lullaby about it. And he sang it for us, and he said, you know, I'm messing up because I'm a guy, and I'm not allowed to sing this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And he had a beautiful singing voice. And you just heard it, and even though you didn't know the words, something was moving inside your soul. And so by virtue of that, they literally unearthed the story of the decimation of a culture and the few things that the members of that culture had been able to hang on to over the course of generations and transit across the ocean and slavery and oppression and repression until a little boy remembers hearing his grandma sing a song that he couldn't understand. And when you wipe out cultures, you wipe out that. And when you don't know, and when people don't know where they came from, they certainly don't know where they're going. And they are much easier to reduce to a sort of consumerist slave status, whereby we have no other external ability to define ourselves than to define ourselves by what kind of plastic crap from Chinese slave laborers we have.
Right.
And that stuff, right. And see, that stuff just, for me, maybe it's mental illness. Maybe I need to seek treatment. But that all just sort of falls together like little puzzle pieces for me.
Yeah, you know, I got some blueberries recently, and I had mixed feelings about it because it was in this plastic box, you know, and, you know, there are better packaging approaches, I think, you know, that don't, create giant, you know, trash continents in the oceans and stuff like that. And, so, you know, it's interesting. I learned the story about it, how in India they had these clay cups for their chai tea. And they'd get a little bit of the clay, they'd swallow a little bit of it, some of the dirt, but they're like, that's okay, that's our mother. And but anyway, and they just throw the cups on the ground, and they quickly decompose and go back into the soil. And
break all you want, we'll make more.
That's right. But now they're made of plastic. And they don't break down. And, you know, they're another created demand for more oil. So, yeah. Anyway,
packaging drives me crazy.
Yeah, and it's a cultural assault of sorts. But it can be rediscovered, and I think it is being rediscovered in many ways. I mean, the whole mix of green business and green government initiatives around the world. So it's not just disappointments in D.C. We see so much of that, but there are governments in other parts of the world doing very creative, sane things here and there. You know, Germany, their solar power and wind is just massive. And they're one of the cloudiest countries in the world, but they're making it happen, and it's a great thing to see. Other experiments and projects in healthcare. But, you know, Denver here, my city, we're talking about bringing back streetcars. So, you know, there's some progress.
Yeah, there is some progress. It just, it needs to be pushed harder.
You're right.
And that is an obligation that falls upon us. You know, for people, it's very easy. You know, David from Maine was talking about Obama a little bit ago. It's very easy for people to wrap their heads around one individual.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got to make Obama do this. We've got to make Obama do that. Well, what do you say you walk out your door and go hook up with somebody and make something happen in your neighborhood?
Yeah. In addition to pressuring Obama, you know, what are we urging ourselves to do? You know, what are we contributing instead of projecting so much on others? Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, and people, again, sometimes it's a matter of people kind of finding opportunities, you know, where to apply their, you know, what's in their heart and what their political concerns are and stuff like that. But anyway, a lot of stuff is becoming available. I think that community-supported agriculture movement is great to see. Monsanto executives can't stand it, but it's growing.
Well, you know the USDA got sued today, right?
No, I missed that.
I had a headline from the folks at Truth Out from Mike Ludwig. A coalition of farmers and environmental groups filed a lawsuit against the USDA, back on March 18th, to challenge the agency's recent decision to fully deregulate Monsanto's Roundup Ready alfalfa.
Mm.
And you know what? You got to keep doing it. The latest lawsuit has been filed by groups like the Center for Food Safety and the National Family Farm Coalition. So, you know, they're not simply going away. They're not simply going to sit still and let this happen.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's and I, you know, I mean, how can I say this? I understand a little bit about being involved in a struggle that does not bear immediate satisfactory results.
Yeah.
But you know what? It has not slowed me down.
Yeah.
And none of the people of intense goodwill who are engaged in it, the struggle against mountaintop removal and the struggle for essential basic Appalachian human rights, none of them have walked away either and said, "Wow, screw it, I'm done."
I liked how you put it earlier, how we're not ahead of the game, but we're in the game. You know, we're engaging however we can. And so we'll see. But quickly, when I went in today, when I went to work, and I approached this person I work with, and oftentimes it was about a sports thing or something, but today I asked her if she had ever heard of Nina Simone, and it turns out she saw Nina Simone in Senegal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, on a cultural exchange years ago, and so I think, you know, that was, you know, she was in Egypt for about a year, and she taught in Ghana, and you know, that's where I guess everybody's mom is from, Ghana. That's the original Eve.
Yeah.
You say. And I think there are a lot of Eve stories, you know. But, you know, I like that narrative as well. So anyway, I think that was a good example of how on the surface our discussions can be so, you know, not quite getting to some issues at times, you know, avoiding some issues, but it's fun to discover people and what they're really up to, what their lives are like. And they may not be politically engaged per se, but they always have interesting, often noble life stories in and of themselves, you know, just the strength of people raising their kids. And, you know, if they have time for a garden, fantastic, but you know, whatever. So many creative things that people are doing just in their daily living that I admire a lot. So, anyway.
Right. Well, Preston, I'm going to roll along. It's been a great conversation. I got one more blinking light if there's somebody there. I want to make sure that they get their licks in for Friday on the front porch. It's awfully good to hear from you.
Likewise, and thanks again for that interview with Cultural Survival. I'm going to send some money their way for sure, and thank them again for their discussion with you.
Well, bless your heart, and tell them you heard about them here.
You bet.
All right, thank you, Preston. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. That is the Horns resident optimist. I always enjoy my conversations with Preston in Denver, simply because he is determined to see a world in which he and others can make a difference, and to urge others that, in fact, they can make a positive difference. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Haven.
Hey, Haven, what's up, man?
Not too much. Just had some thoughts about the end of empires and that sort of thing, such as NATO on some level.
Cool.
As well as Duke University.
Ah. Yeah. Goodbye, yeah. Duke.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Didn't see that one coming.
Me neither. Me neither. No, who did? Who did? Except maybe, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening these days that we don't see coming. You know? Nobody saw Egypt coming. Nobody saw Tunisia coming. Nobody saw, you know, even Libya, you know, and still trying to figure that one out.
Perfect. Yeah, but I'm not so shallow yet, Haven, that I'm willing to completely equate Mike Krzyzewski with Muammar Gaddafi. I could. If you give me five or 10 minutes, I could probably get there, but I'm just not willing to do it right now.
Right. Okay. I had actually a question. I don't know if you, I know you've talked quite a bit about Libya, but one thing I hadn't heard, I haven't looked it up on Wikipedia yet, but why is Gaddafi referred to as Colonel Gaddafi? I mean, who is the head of state of Libya? And does that, I mean, this is something that everybody calls him Colonel Gaddafi and that sort of thing, but do they have a president? What, I mean, do they have a prime minister? Or, I mean, I understand that it,
They have some structures, but I mean, he is the de facto, he's the tyrant. And bear in mind, Haven, I use the word tyrant not in its wholly pejorative sense, but in its ancient and classical sense. He is the tyrant was the Greek word, the Latin equivalent was dictator. He is the one whose word is law. And, you know, why is he colonel? Maybe that was the highest rank he achieved, and he just, there was nobody else to promote him. But he stayed colonel the whole time. And I guess it's been good enough for him.
Colonel is a pretty powerful position, apparently. He's a colonel. Of course, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North had apparently a heck of a lot more power than, people gave him credit for.
Absolutely. Colonels are the people who do the groundwork, who implement the orders of the generals. You know, generals don't lead people into battle anymore. That would be
right.
You know, because remember, the Army and Marine and Air Force colonel is the functional rank equivalent of a Navy captain. And, you know, a captain is God Almighty.
Oh.
You know, well, and the thing is, you know, even if you're a lieutenant commander or whatever, a captain of a vessel is God Almighty on the sea.
Mm.
And so, you know, maybe there's some of that, the ultimate power to implement policy. That's about the best I can do, I think.
The practical part of that, the actual day-to-day, I'm not grunt, but something along those, something who, the person to answer to on that day-to-day level of implementing that sort of, that policy from on high, that sort of thing.
Right. And I'm sure I'll get a lot of feedback from folks saying, well, Bob, you don't have it quite right, but you know, it's, I don't know, close enough for government work, shall we say?
Yeah. Well, I'm off to see what UNC is doing tonight. They are playing Marquette tonight, so I'm going to see what's going on with that.
That might be more, that might be more than an interesting game.
Yes. Yeah. That, I kind of see what's coming there. But,
you know, because, well, I love the fact that I like it whenever the people who set up the field of 64 or 68 now, I like it whenever their plans come to naught, because their whole goal was to wind up with a UNC Duke national championship. And it just didn't play out for them. And, you know, Pitt's gone. It's not exactly what they had in mind. I'm still mad at him for forcing the WVU Kentucky rematch. I thought that was a little bit of dirty pool.
Ohio State is going to be is going to upset quite a few people, quite a few odds makers, I think.
It could very well happen, but I mean, they were occupying a pretty sweet position in the beginning. I mean, they were as much set up as anybody to run the table.
To roll, yeah. But, I have some, I've been looking up, Googling things about, going broke. There's a article about Georgia going broke, and I will actually call back in about that later. Because that story's not going anywhere. That's an ongoing.
Well, I'm tired of hearing this Republican mantra of "we're broke, we're broke, we're broke." We ain't broke.
And that's what prompted me to start Googling that. And there are a few articles here and there asking the question, or news stories, TV, radio, and whatnot: is blank broke? Is Georgia broke?
Right, exactly.
Our particular city, our particular state, our particular county broke.
Yeah, that's the for-profit media just marching lockstep with what the right wing's telling them. Hey, Haven, I got to get out of here because we are literally seconds away from Rick Smith. But it's good to hear from you, and you have a great weekend.
You too.
All right, bye now. That's Haven, and it is time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Everybody, thank you.